Translation purport by Srila Prabhupada. As Bhogavati, the capital of Nagaloka, is protected by the Nagas, so is Dwarka protected by the descendants of Vrishni, Bhoja, Madhu, Dashahara, Arha, Kukura, Andika, etc., who are as strong as Lord Krishna. Purport. The Nagaloka planet is situated below the earth planet, and it is understood that the sun rays are hampered there. The darkness of the planet is, however, removed by the flashes of the jewels set on the heads of the Nagas, celestial serpents, and it is said that there are beautiful gardens, rivulets, etc., for the enjoyment of the Nagas. It is understood here also that the place is well protected by the inhabitants. So also the city of Dwarka was well protected by the descendants of Vrishni, who are as powerful as the Lord, insofar as he manifested his strength upon this earth. Text 12. Sarva tu sarva vibhava punya vriksha latash shamai udyano pavanaramar rita pada karastriyam. The city of Dwarkapuri was filled with opulences of all seasons. There are hermitages, orchards, flower gardens, parks and reservoirs of water, breeding lotus flowers all over. So what did I just say? Where were the lotus flowers? In Dwarkapuri. Anything else? Yes. I'll read it again. Just the city of Dwarkapuri was filled with the opulences of all seasons. There were hermitages, orchards, flower gardens, parks, and reservoirs of water breeding lotus flowers all over. So what was there in Dwarkapuri? What was the first thing? Yes. And then after that there were? What else? And? Reservoirs of water. So purport. Perfection of human civilization is made possible by utilizing the gifts of nature in their own way. As we find herein in the description of its opulence, Dwarka was surrounded by flower gardens and fruit orchards, along with the reservoirs of water and growing lotuses. There is no mention of mills and factories supported by slaughterhouses, which are necessary paraphernalia of the modern metropolis. The propensity to utilize nature's own gifts is still there, even in the hearts of modern civilized man. The leaders of modern civilization select their own residential quarters in a place where there are such naturally beautiful gardens and reservoirs of water, but they leave the common man to reside in congested areas without parks and gardens. Herein, of course, we find a different description of the city of Dwarka. It is understood that the whole dam, or residential quarter, was surrounded by such gardens and parks with reservoirs of water where lotuses grew. It is understood that all the people depended on nature's gifts of fruits and flowers without industrial enterprises promoting filthy huts and slums for residential quarters. Advancement of civilization is estimated not on the growth of mills and factories to deteriorate the finer instincts of the human being, but on developing the potent spiritual instincts of living beings and giving them a chance to go back to Godhead. Development of factories and mills is called Ugra Karma, or pungent activities. And such activities deteriorate the finest sentiments of the human being and society to form a dungeon of demons. We find here in the mention of pious trees which produce seasonal flowers and fruits. The impious trees are useless jungles only, and they can only be used to supply fuels. In the modern civilization, such impious trees are planted on the sides of roads. Human energy should be properly utilized into developing the finer senses for spiritual understanding, in which the solution of life, in which lies the solution of life. Fruits, flowers, beautiful gardens, parks and reservoirs of water with ducks and swans, playing in the midst of lotus flowers and cows giving sufficient milk and butter are essential for developing the finer tissues of the human body. As against this, the dungeons and mines, factories and workshops develop demoniac propensities in the working class. The vested interests flourish at the cost of the working class, and consequently there are severe clashes between them in so many ways. The description of Dwarkadham is the ideal of human civilization. Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutai Srimate Bhaktivedanta Swami Tanamane Namaste Sarasvatam Deve Kauravani Vacharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschadya De Siddharane. In Dwarkadham there were the opulences of all the different seasons. And this is true also in Krishnaloka. Krishnaloka, if you go there, there are no movie houses, so most people wouldn't want to go there. Someone was asking me the other day about the analogy that Prabhupada was giving about working in the mind. And one preacher went there, and he was describing to them what hell is like. That if you don't surrender to Lord Jesus Christ, you'll have to go to hell. So the workers in the mind were inquiring, who is Lord Jesus Christ, and what is his number? Because everyone who worked in the mine, they had a particular number, so they thought he must be one of the workers. And if we don't surrender to him, then we'll have to go to some place called hell. So he said, no, the preacher was saying, you don't understand. Lord Jesus Christ, he's the Son of God. If you don't surrender to him, you'll have to go to hell. So the workers were curious, and they asked him, what is hell like? So he said, it is very, very dark there. There's hardly any good air. There's very cold, and sometimes very, very hot. So the workers thought, well, this sounds like our mind. It's not so bad. So the preacher was noticing that the workers were not very much impressed by his sermon, so then he added, but there's no newspaper there. And they said, no newspaper, abominable. How abominable? How can we surrender to Jesus Christ? So similarly, if modern man, at least in some parts, if they hear that in the spiritual world there are parks and gardens, and there are lotus flowers and birds and ducks and cows giving milk, they think, let us go there and kill the cows and cut down all the trees and make some money. It is very hard for modern man to appreciate that this is actually advancement. People think that advancement means, just like in many places, the number of movie theaters and the number of restaurants, the number of shopping malls. That this is real advancement of civilization. That if a civilization, just like in America, they have shopping malls the size of cities. There are shopping malls with 400 or 500 stores in them. And you can go there and spend the whole day or month or whatever, going from store to store, looking at all the products, and one may think, oh, this is great advancement, that I can get green and white and pink and polka dot and striped, all different shoes. There are millions of different varieties of shoes. There are different varieties of pocketbooks and so many different types of watches. And there's one with Mickey Mouse, one with Donald Duck, one with a Rolex watch, a green watch, a pink. So people think that this is really the mercy of the higher powers that we have such opulence. And if they hear about the simple city of Dwarkapuri, they think that these people are country bumpkins, they say in America. Where is the fun? They're simply down on the farm. You know, what are they doing? Just waiting to get a ticket to get to the city so they can get into real fun. So that's the, if a modern person is put into the country, he becomes very disturbed. If he's in the city with all the noise and all the traffic and all the air pollution and all the congestion and all the fear and anxiety, then he feels perfectly at home. He feels like a fish in water. But as soon as he's put into the country, then he's immediately becomes, his mind becomes very disturbed, trying to hear what's going on. He can't hear anything, so he gets into anxiety. There's nothing happening, so he becomes very fearful. He can breathe the air, which he never hardly can breathe. Now he feels that this is too much. I'm overusing my lungs here. So being put into such an environment, he becomes actually very much on edge, so to speak. He becomes very much disturbed. And he wants to get back to the city again to begin his real life of working in the factory and turning the screw, 5,000 screws every day to the right, making a better world. Because people are not accustomed to what is actually valuable, they take as some metal car that can drive on the road is actually great opulence. Or if some country can build a skyscraper 110 stories instead of 109, then they're actually getting, they're a very high civilization. High thinking. And they become the more or less, everyone is thinking, when can I go to the sacred place? For instance, I think here, even in Europe nowadays, it's considered advanced because now they have Disneyland here in Europe. I think they have Disneyland here. So now you can go to a place. I mean, the material world itself is a place of fantasy where everyone is imagining themselves to be something that they're not. And in the midst of this fantasy, you can go to another fantasy. A fantasy in the midst of the fantasy and imagine yourself to be in a fantasy world while you're in your own fantasy world. And there the hero is a mouse who they're... Generally, if they see a mouse, the lady screams and jumps on a chair. The children get their baseball bat to go and give it a good club on the head. They lie in wait with their trap to get the little thing, giving them a little cheese so they can squash him with their mouse trap. But in this fairyland, he's the hero. And he has his Minnie Mouse and Donald Duck and so many other fantasies. And they think that this is great advancement. And if someone is praying to God, worshiping God, then he's trying to escape reality. If he takes his family to Disneyland to see the duck and the mouse and some other creatures, then he's actually, you know, a noble person and educating his family in the proper spirit. So this is, of course, not according to the Srimad Bhagavatam. So people may find great difficulty reading what's in these books. Although civilization has not become so degraded that at least many people can appreciate, you know, some of the message. The first time I went to New Vrindavan, which was in 1969, probably at that time they had just started New Vrindavan some months earlier. And coming from the city myself. I wasn't, well, of course I used to go out in the country during the summer. But we drove up. There was in the car Jagadish Prabhu, Bhagavan Prabhu and his wife, Krishna Bhamati, who weren't initiated yet. Bhakti Bob and Irene. And we were going to see Prabhupada at New Vrindavan, see what New Vrindavan was. And they left us off on the road. And in front of us was 4 kilometers of mud, because it was in May, right after the rainy season. So, of course, at that time, our paraphernalia was tongs, these bathroom tongs. You know, the bathroom tongs, plastic tongs. So it wasn't that we came with boots or anything. And the only clothes we had was dhotis, and it wasn't that everyone had socks either. So my foot took my first step into the New Vrindavan, where it wasn't even the New Vrindavan land, but on my way to Oz, took the first step and my foot sunk 2 feet into the ground, into the mud. So I thought, well, why don't we come back later? In any case, the other devotees were more enthusiastic than I was, and we, after 4 hours or 5 hours of sinking into the mud, we finally arrived at New Vrindavan, the promised land, which happened to be one shack in the middle of nowhere. Shack about half this, a quarter of the size of this room. And at that time, Bhakti Bob, myself, went up to see Prabhupada. And Prabhupada was in the attic of the shack. And Prabhupada was sitting on his bed when we came up, and he smiled at us. And he said, "So, how do you like our jungle?" So I didn't say anything, but I was thinking. It wasn't exactly what I expected. And then, after Prabhupada was talking for some time, we went down and we went to where Kirtananda was living, which was just a little hut, just big enough for 3 of us to fit into. And he said, "Yes, Prabhupada said that all we need is a little land and a cow, and all our economic problems are solved." So at that time I was the treasurer of the temple. I was always trying to figure out, because the only one who was working was our temple president, Rupanuga, and that was our main source of income besides our whatever book distribution and collections we had. So I was always worried about how we were going to support the temple. So I couldn't figure out how, if we bought some land and got a cow, it would solve all our problems. And then Hari Griva called us over a little bit later and to show us what it was. So he wanted us to clear away all the weeds and the bramble and the bushes to solve the economic problems. So that concept was not very familiar with most of the devotees. That simple living, living simply by growing food and having a cow, that would solve our economic problems. But that's what Krishna says, anad bhavati bhutani parjanan anasambhava. That first of all, the main necessity for life is anad, or food grains. That unless there's food, that no one can feel satisfied. That indeed, if there was no prasad, then there probably wouldn't be any devotees. Even when Prabhupada came, he said that, "I thought I'd come to the Western world and I'd tell people no illicit sex, no gambling, no meat eating, no intoxication." And they'd say, "Swamiji, none of these things, you go home." Prabhupada thought, "I'd say these things and they'd tell me to go home." He said, "But actually, I told them these things. And then we gave them prasadam, and the devotees liked prasadam very much, the people who came." That in the beginning, people were probably more attracted to prasadam than anything else. the Sunday feast. Prabhupada one time said that it is not that they're coming to hear the lecture. This is in Hyderabad, and I think around 1976. And at that time, the leaders of Hyderabad had prepared some food, which was not, actually they didn't prepare it. They had hired one sweeper. The sweeper, he made the food. And Prabhupada had heard about the food, and I guess he may have even tasted some of it. And he said that this is not, even a dog wouldn't even eat this. He said, and you're serving this to people, you're expecting them to come here. He said, you have a sweeper preparing, you know, food, and it's not even fit for a dog. A dog wouldn't even accept it. He said, what do you think people are coming? They're not coming here to hear Swami to give some lecture. They're coming here to eat, you know, for some nice meal. And then he said, if you, you know, why didn't you tell me then? If you have no money, then I'll give you the money. So Prabhupada also emphasized, he says in Srimad Bhagavatam, that no function is complete unless there is nice prasadam. No function would be complete. And indeed, in the beginning, Prabhupada was very pleased that the devotees liked prasadam. There was one devotee named Stridish that his mother said, yes, you can have Stridisha can stay in the temple if you take care of him. So Prabhupada more or less tried to act like a father to Stridish. At the beginning, Stridish would hardly eat one chapati. He's very reluctant to eat. But then after eating one chapati, then he got two chapatis. Then after some days, he was eating three chapatis. Then he got up to 25 chapatis. And Prabhupada made the limit 25 chapatis. I remember one time I went to the temple. At that time, they had moved to 61 Second Avenue. And it was time for the Sunday feast. And all the guests lined up, the devotees lined up, but the devotees lined up in front of all the guests. And I didn't know what was going on, so I lined up with the guests. I didn't butt in with the devotees. So by the time they got to us, all the prasadam was done. It was gone. So Prabhupada didn't like that very much, that the Sunday feast was gone even before the guests would get it. Luckily, one of the devotees took me in the back and they had Simply Wonderfuls left. So that was my Sunday feast. But the devotees obviously developed an appreciation for prasadam. The first time I went to Ramachandra's appearance day was I'd come back from the university. I was a devotee at that time, but in 69, and they were fasting until moonrise at that time. That was the fast. And Brahmananda Prabhu ran up to me, picked me up and embraced me, and he said, did you do it? I said, what? He said, have you fasted so far? So I said, yeah, I didn't realize it was such an accomplishment. And then it was time for the feast, and literally the devotees, they had a mound of prasadam, looked like little Govardhan hills. And that was first. And those were rapidly gone. Actually, all the prasad, I remember that year, was all green. Mother Balai put green dye into everything to remind us of Lord Ramachandra. And there was literally, the devotees were eating mountains and mountains of prasadam. So that became more or less the standard. At the beginning in Buffalo, when I was there, then everyone used to cook. Even I used to cook, but I didn't know how to cook because I was a fruitarian before I joined. All I ate was bananas. Because when you live in Buffalo in the winter, Buffalo, New York is like there's 2 meters of snow on the ground. You don't really expect to get a whole lot of fruit. So it's not very common to be a fruitarian in Buffalo at that time. And there were no health food stores. They didn't exist. It was only the supermarket. So the only thing they had was bananas. So I spent 3 or 4 months just eating bananas. And then when I joined the temple, they asked me to cook, but I didn't know how to cook any of these things. So it was quite an austerity for a lot of devotees. So then some of the devotees got the idea that we should cook every day just like Prabhupada was there. So that meant quite opulently. And then for the Sunday feast, the idea was to eat as much prasadam as you could possibly eat. So you eat as much prasadam as you could until most of the devotees would practically fall unconscious. That was considered a good feast. I was the Sankirtan leader also, so I was in charge of trying to get everyone to go out on book distribution and Harinam after the Sunday feast. So I remember one of my friends, Jagadish, when I asked him to go, he said, "You're an impersonalist." Anyhow, the point is that prasadam is actually very important in the life of a devotee. Not only is it important in the life of a devotee, but it's proper food is important in the life of every living entity. That without food, that no one can become satisfied. Therefore, Krishna emphasizes that life is based upon food grain. Even if one doesn't have any accommodation, even if one doesn't have any material facility, but if there is proper food, then one can somehow or another survive and be satisfied. And even if one has everything else, if there's not proper food, then one cannot be happy or satisfied. And here we find not only proper food, but in the life of a civilized person, there are other requirements that make one feel contented and peaceful. If you go to the bookstore, last time I went to a bookstore in Australia, I was looking for medical books, and practically 90% of the books were all dealing with stress, the disease of modern man, that everyone is in anxiety, and people are trying to figure out how to become free from stress. So here it mentions that if you have nice parks, if you go to, I'm sure here that somewhere they must have a park, right? Probably all the cities, they have parks. And in most of the parks, not in Europe, I think people use the parks more than in America. But in America, if you watch the videos of Prabhupada walking in, say, Golden Gate Park or in the parks in Detroit, different types of parks, you'll see that there's no one in the park except for the birds. Hardly anyone compared to the amount of parks there are. Of course, in America, it is dangerous to go to the parks. The only people in the parks are the thieves at night. But people generally don't take advantage of the park because they're working all day long and they pay the taxes so that they can keep the parks going. But hardly anyone, maybe a few people on the weekend, venture out to the park and throw some breadcrumbs to the ducks because the kids want to go and feed the ducks. Therefore, they go out to the park. But factually, modern society doesn't understand the value, as it says here, of nice flowers and fruits and orchards and clear reservoirs of water. That these things are more or less mythology to most people. Even sometimes they have to take children. I remember when I was living in New York, they had to take children on excursions so they can go out to the country and see the wildlife, the wild animals like the cows. And and a goat. See the wildlife out in the country. see a bird and, you know, things like grasshoppers and all these strange exotic animals and insects. So they get experience beyond just what it says in the books. So this is modern society, but somehow or another people think that this is actually advancement. And they have plans that they're going to expand the city. So instead of the city being 5 or 20 kilometers across, they can have cities connecting to cities, connecting to cities, so that you no longer have to go out and see all the different barbaric regions called country, where there's all this pure air and maybe even fresh water and cows and ducks and swans, which distract one from the real mission of life of enjoying one's senses to the utmost. This boring cows and things like that. So people are actually thinking that they're making advancement the more they have all these cities and factories, whatever. But those who have some, Prabhupada mentions here that those who actually can afford it, generally they move out to the country. That if a person is really wealthy, he may have a place in the city, but undoubtedly he has some place out in the country. And he surrounds his place with walls that are 5 meters high, barbed wire and guards everywhere, so no one can come in and take his flowers or steal his fruits. Because these things are actually valuable. Although in the city, when I was in Texas, for instance, there's a law against growing any fruit trees on the road. Any tree that gives actual fruit. The only thing you're allowed to grow is trees that look like they have fruits, but don't really have any real fruits on them. So they have all these orange trees on the road, but if you get one of the oranges and open it up, there's no juice inside. There's only pulp. There's only pulp and seeds. I mean, I can't imagine why they have these laws, but obviously they're afraid that people are going to stop working, or they're going to simply go out and pick the fruits from the road and they won't buy them from the stores. So they end the competition so that people don't get their food too easily. They make laws like that. And now, of course, they have all kinds of, as time is going on, they have new laws. Now they have biological fruit. So that fruit is manufactured with things like genes from animals. So you may get a strawberry which is partially pig genes. I mean, that's a reality. It's just... And not only that, but then they radiate it with radiation. Because, at least as I read in one book, they were making all these radioisotopes and they didn't know what to do with them. From all these reactors, and they were getting all these isotopes coming out. So they decided that the best thing to do with them is to feed them to the people. Make money from it. So they found out that if you make the food radioactive to some degree, then its shelf life increases. That although it becomes rotten, you can't notice it. It looks like it's fresh. You could take an apple, for instance, or even milk, and put it under radioactivity, and It can look like milk for years, although it's, you know, who knows what it actually is. So this way they can increase the shelf life. So they made it a law that all the food had to become had to be put under radioactivity. So you can get a strawberry that was half pig. And it was radioactivized so that it was actually grown in, 3 years ago. And it looks like a strawberry. Sometimes it's 5 times as big as a normal strawberry should be. You have to take it home in a wheel car. But it has nothing, the only thing, it has nothing really to do with what a real strawberry is. But people think that this is advancement. Of course, it sounds like an exaggeration, but actually it's based upon fact. And they think that this is progress. But real progress is, that's why one of the reasons why Prabhupada wanted us to have our own farms and grow our own food, because as Kali Yuga progresses, then people's idea about what progress is becomes more and more away from reality. So in Bhagavad Gita, ultimately, the idea is to live life in such a simple way is that one can always become Krishna conscious, always remain Krishna conscious. And of course, if we look at the ideal life, which is the life in the spiritual world, there is Krishna, and what is he doing? He doesn't get up in the morning, and his mother Jasoda says, I hope you get a job today. Or she said, don't worry, kid, I packed you lunch, I hope you have a good day at the factory. No, in the spiritual world, there are no factories. So then what do people do? If there are no factories, there are no movie theaters. It's not that the kids, they wake up in the morning, they say, Mom, could I go to the movie theater? Can you give me some money for the movie theater, or go to the candy store, or buy some drugs? No, Krishna gets up in the morning, and he goes and milks the cows. So if people heard this, they think, this is abominable. Child labor. Why don't they get a machine to milk the cows? Why do they got the kids doing it? And then he goes out after milking the cows, he comes back and takes breakfast, and then he goes out with the cows. And they're thinking, what kind of education are they giving these kids? What are they going to do when they grow up? What kind of job is he going to get? He's going to stay, milking cows forever? So people think that this is crazy. What are they doing? What kind of civilization is that? Why don't they educate the kids so they can become scientists or something? But Krishna, all day long, he's simply going with the cows, and the cows are eating the grass, and Krishna and the coward boys are dancing and playing games all day long. And then sometimes he goes to Radhakund and dances with the gopis, and they come back and they have this huge feast. Krishna pretends he goes to sleep and then goes out to dance with the gopis again. And then they, after dancing, they bathe in the Jamuna or in Radhakund or Shyamakund. Then they have another big feast, and then they fall asleep and they run home. So, and then Mother Jasoda comes and wakes him up, so he can go out and milk the cows again. So people, they think that, what kind of life is this? It's so simple. He must be bored. What does he do for recreation? But this is actually really life. And previously, the majority of the people in the world used to live such a life. And at that time, we can see that most of the people in the world used to be, at least comparatively, much more God-conscious. That previously, people, what was their recreation? They'd sit home and read the Bible. They'd go to church on Sunday, and at that time, people were more or less more God-conscious than they are now. There wasn't so much crime, there wasn't so much pollution. All the bad things that have come with so-called advancement of civilization, and at the same time we can see that if someone is actually God-conscious, then they're considered to be a danger to society, slowing up society's progress. But those who have intelligence, they'll be able to perceive and appreciate that the natural life of nature, with fresh air and flowers and trees and fruits and nice food, that this is actually real life, and that the life of ugra karma mentioned here, which more or less is based upon the assumption that human progress will depend upon manufacturing, you know, so many machines and so many different types of so-called amenities, that this type of progress is actually not really factually progress of consciousness or even of real material happiness or peace or enjoyment. So, of course, this concept is rather foreign to some people, but there are also growing people who are more conscious of these things, that the ecological imbalances that modern man has brought to the nature is actually not progressing nature. Recently, they had a conference a couple of years ago in Brazil to talk about after the year 2000, what will be the problems of the world. And they decided that the main cause of wars after the year 2000 will be over water, fresh water. That fresh water will be so rare that people will fight, and countries will fight each other to get water. So believe it or not, I remember when I grew up, which was not really ancient history, that I remember the first time I saw a machine on the street where you had to buy water. I couldn't believe it, that they're actually selling water on the street. And then within a few years, so many years, it became that it was known that you better not drink the tap water if you want to survive. Some places you turn on the tap water and different types of living entities would come out. First, you know, this red and yellow stuff would come out. And then after that, sometimes we'd be followed by different living entities trying to escape. No, I mean, I'm serious. It was in some places. And then it became clear that it wasn't safe to drink the water. And then they started to put in fluorine and chlorine. You know, even now I'm sure you take the water and suddenly this fizz comes up and this, you know, this cloud comes. You smell the cloud and you practically pass out. Because chlorine is what they used to use to kill people during World War I. It was outlawed. So now they put it into the water to kill, you know, anything that might be moving in it. But then, you know, you have to drink it. So now most people drink, at least people who can afford it, which is not that much, that many people, they drink bottled water. Or at least they get a filter for their water. So this is as civilization goes on, even to get water is rare, good water is rare. And now in some cities they sell oxygen on the street. In Tokyo, yeah. Tokyo, you can go and you can purchase air. because of the air pollution is so bad that some people die on the street due to lack of air. So now you can go and purchase it. So it may be a good business for the devotees to get into, selling air. Of course, it may be patentized. So when they take a patent on air, you may not even be able to sell it. So I think I'll stop there. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? Yes.
How would the rest of mind be fit for simple living? How can you...
Practice. Everything takes practice. By Prabhupada wanted the devotees to show a good example of how to live simply and at the same time become happy and Krishna conscious. So without becoming happy in Krishna consciousness, then no one could actually understand how to live simply. Because the idea is not simple living and low thinking. Because then people are not accustomed to that. They usually, you know, low living and low thinking, but not simple living. So Prabhupada wanted us to show the example how to be happy with the simple necessities of life, but happy in Krishna consciousness. So that's the only way it's really possible in this age to live simply. And it takes practice. Thank you very much. Grantharaj Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Gaur Premanande.